Hello, everyone. Welcome to the official Outlander podcast. I'm Matt Roberts, executive producer and writer on the show. Welcome to episode 706, Where the Waters Meet. Little bit about that. The title was originally Ticonderoga, and through our consultants found out that that best translation is Where the Waters Meet, so we mixed it up and called it that. Anyway, this episode, if you're on the podcast, then you've already seen it once. Maybe you watch for the first time and view the do it with the podcast. I don't know. I that was an assumption on my part, and please forgive. So this is one of those episodes that we found, as I said in the last podcast, we found a great fort not far from our studio in Scotland, and we enhanced that with visual effects and just a massive amount of set deck, what we call set decoration. So we call it the set deck. And they built this fort out, and it was just astonishing when you actually walk through the doors or the gates, as William did. So right now what you're looking at is that stone structure that he just rode by was a visual effects structure. But the wood is the actual fort. So we enhance here and there with actual practical building. And so all the tents you see and the practical little buildings within the fort, like this building back there, those are there. And we just decorate. So all around, all the baskets and I guess that would be a gazebo in the modern world. We build those out. But the stone structure is all visual effects. And so to integrate that, we spend months, of course, going through the process of concepts. This is what it might look like. This is what it might, you know, and we pick what we think is the best, of course, in keeping with what Ticonderoga looked like, what was described at the time, and what people, if you were to go to Fort Ticonderoga today, what exists today. So we thought, since we couldn't build a whole stone structure, nor could we create enough space for all our actors to move around in, around blue screens, which if we did with blue screens, that's where we would put replace the blue screens with the stone structure. We felt like that would be a huge undertaking to accomplish. And it also, I think, distracts from the performances, because when you put the actors in a real world, a real setting, it gives them the ability to become that character, I think, in a much smoother transition, rather than pretending to be, you know, someone against blue screen. It's a challenge. And I know a lot of movies and television shows go down that road. But what we like to do is find the most practical spot and put the actors in a real world situation. And that can only benefit the realism of the show. So it's like getting, you know, all the actors and the supporting artists on boats and canoes. You know, some of these guys working in here are stunts. So some of the men and women are the stunt performers, especially the ones who are rowing and you know, operating the canoes. And, you know, of course, we know Sam and Katrina both and John Bell in this instance do as much as they possibly can. when it comes to what we would call a stunt, you know, or an action piece. They like to, of course, we like them too, and they like to do as much as they possibly can when it's safe. That's the key. When safety is an issue, of course, we see how far it can go, but we keep everybody's safety is a main concern. So I'm sorry for the pause. I know that sometimes I pause. I just like to sometimes see what's going on in the show and catch back up. The challenges of scenes like this, where we have multiple supporting artists and child actors, is we only have a certain amount of time we can film, certainly with children. You only get a certain amount of hours per day with the children. So what we do to schedule that is you schedule their work first and you get all those shots done, even if it's not in story order. And then you work kind of off of that. So when you get all the children's work done, then you can start working on scenes where the children aren't in the scene. So if you've noticed throughout the years, what'll happen is you'll see strategically children in a scene, they're doing something, you know, whatever the action calls for. And then all of a sudden, oh, everybody's got to go to bed. The children are over there in that bedroom or bed chamber or tent, or they're behind a bush, or, you know, they've gone up because we got to get them out of the scene because they only, again, we only have so many hours with them. So you try to do that. And then story-wise, you try to have some plausible reason why they're not in the scene anymore. You know, when at the big house, you know, Lizzie would take the kids to bed, or, you know, certain things like that. We just to help us gain more and more time filming is the reason we do it. Finding this school, I thought, you know, our locations department did a great job. We wanted a school feel like a school, of course. And, you know, when you're filming during school hours, it's hard to find. So this was a great find. I loved these scenes. One of the fun things about this particular season that the beginning of the season, you look at it and you go, this is going to be a big challenge. How are we going to do time periods? How are we going to do all these time periods when they're in the middle of the block? You know, we have, you know, in the middle of the block, you're doing Ticonderoga, you're doing 1980s Scotland, you're bouncing all over the place. And what started to happen is the crew, the cast started to kind of fall in love with this time period and the challenges that it brought on. But the excitement level really went up as, hey, we get to find a school. We get to put all these characters in 80s clothing and, you know, what was going on at that time? What were people listening to on the radio? What was the political atmosphere of the time? You know, just, you know, we really dug in deep, because that would say what was on the walls or what was in the background, if we were hearing anything. So that it actually in both ways, it was a challenge, but it was also very fun. And the thing that Outlander gives, you know, from day one, that gives to us, those of us that are trying to bring it to life, is there's newness all the time. And again, there are challenges that come with newness. And as those of you who have been with us from season one, you know, season one was all of Scotland. They get on a ship at the end and they go to France. Season two, the first half was in France. So we had to rebuild that. And sorry, this the Miss Raven just shot herself, so it was a little shocking. But it also invigorates and excites the cast and the crew that they get to be going, they get to go to these new places and new sets and new worlds. Almost every season we've done that. So I think for us, this season seven, going to the 80s was a new thing for us. And it really helped invigorate and excite the cast and crew, and hopefully the audience as well. So we had a little bit of time, a little bit of issue with continuity here. And I'm not going to lie that I like to obfuscate this where no one ever notices, and hopefully you didn't. But Jamie and Ian obviously come upon Miss Raven's body in she's dead, and it's daylight, whereas Claire just saw this happen at night, even though this was all filmed at the same time. And what we try to do is we try to in post figure out how we can, it's called color timing, where we do day for night or night for day, you know, it's where we adjust the lighting of a daytime scene to make it look more like night. So when Katrina filmed that, the earlier scene, it was probably more daytime than it was nighttime. And we just brought it down to make it look more night. I always enjoy the that when we work around story, you know, when we're working through the story and someone says, well, why would Claire be so bossy with a soldier? And you say to that person who gave that note, have you met Claire? And then that usually ends that particular conversation. So it's just part of her. There's this fearlessness to her that it's in the books, it's on the page, in the scripts, it's how Katrina plays her. And it obviously I think it's one of those traits that Jamie sees in her that he fell in love from day one when she was pretty fearless. When she was fixing his shoulder way back in season one. Again, I'm going to go back to talking a little bit about the set here because it was such a big undertaking, and I cannot tip my hat enough to Mike Gunn and the art department team that designed this, and Stuart Bryce. His set deck team that dressed it, and Trisha, who with her team did all the costumes. And you know, where you see it is when the actors come onto the set for the first time, because they don't see it until they show up on the day of filming. And when you see, you know, Katrina and Sam and John and Charles and you see the actors come on set and you see their faces looking at these sets that you've stepped into or out of time. And that to me is probably the biggest compliment that can be paid, is they know they're in the as close to, you know, go stepping back in time as possible. The amount of detail with the flags and what the soldiers are wearing, the stacks of wood in this scene. I mean, just every little thing that you would think, you know, every show misses something. Every show in the world get something off. I like to think that Outlander keeps it to a bare minimum. I'm sure there's an arborist somewhere saying, hey, that tree isn't in North Carolina, or New York. And they would be right. I remember in season six, I think it was, or it might have been five, somebody sent me a missive saying that there was a bird sound on the show that was obviously a Scottish bird. And I can't remember the species offhand, but they said that that bird didn't, wasn't indigenous to North Carolina. And they were probably absolutely 100% right. We cannot, clearing the set is, you know, and keeping everybody quiet while we're filming is a chore when it comes to humans. But, you know, we're certainly not going to clear the set of actual flora and fauna. So I get a little smirk on my face when I read stuff like that, because it happens. The first season, we felt we spent so much time avoiding rhododendron because that wasn't in our world. Thankfully, when we moved to North Carolina, it was in that world, so we didn't have to avoid it as much. So we try. There's a lot of plantation pines in Scotland, and we try to avoid those, or at least break them up with visual effects so they don't look like there's a plantation, because there weren't plantations in this time. Not tree plantations where they're regrowing trees. I think I've said enough about that, or maybe you want to hear more. I don't know, but I'm tapped out on that. Anyway. Again, for those of you keeping track, I am not drinking whiskey again because it's in the morning and I'm alone. So those two factors make it difficult for me to justify drinking whiskey. But I will say, as soon as I start getting some more guests on the show, we start doing it afternoon, then we'll be boozing it up here. That was iced tea. So those of you who ask, or those curious minds, that was iced tea, I swear. I am looking around, trying to think, what in the world can I talk about this particular episode? And I keep falling back to thinking about the whole season. And when the season's always a puzzle. And what story fits? There's chronological, of course. You know, there's the book, the way it's set up in the book. And we try to follow that, of course, as close as we possibly can. The things that give us, challenges and you know, for those of us that sit in meetings about scheduling, and it's like, look, this is a glorious day in Scotland, and that really helps. As you know, we last year were hit with a ton of really bad weather. We had to incorporate that into the story. This year we lucked out in a lot of ways. The weather treated us kindly when it needed to. Like, this is an episode that, being in upstate New York and just the beauty of the day enhances the scene. And you can have those dreary days where it's cloudy and dark and miserable, and sometimes that really helps. Like last episode, when you saw Brianna going to the graveyard, and it was a dreary day, you know, that helps that scene. Certainly the first part of that scene. And it helped us continuity wise, because the first scene it was overcast, that it was easier to do the second scene, because the matching's easier. It's much harder when you have to match sun and no sun. Actually, in there was a season. Oh God, they're all running together on me at season four, where Sam and Sophie did an entire scene. And this is when he was checking the rabbit traps and they were walking along, having a conversation. And it was a really, you know, powerful scene. It was where she was talking about how Bonnet had raped her and Jamie was trying to, you know, make her feel better. And when they did coverage of it, and when they were on Sam's side, it was a nice sunny day. And when they turned the cameras around and worked on the other side, it started to sleet. And there was some hail, I think, when they were on Sophie. So that was the day. That was literally the day they shot it. So when that footage came in, we looked at it. The editor, well, who assembles the show as it's filming. So they put it's called an assembly, and they assemble it along. The director can go in there and look at what's going on, and he or she can, you know, work on the assembly as they go. And so when they got that scene in, there was concerns because, you know, in the same moment, Jamie's talking and it's beautiful, sunny. And in the next moment, it was, a sleet storm. So we realized we had to reshoot the whole scene. So we picked a day that we felt like the weather was going to be at least one or the other. And Sam and Sophie had to go out there and do the whole scene all over again. And that's the one we used in the show. So those are the kinds of things that weather can do to you, whether it's good weather or bad weather. You know, I was filming a scene with Sophie and Richard where the car broke down on this kind of desolate Highland road. And when we started filming, there was a beautiful frost all over everything. And it looked white as far as the eye could see. It was beautiful. And then when we were doing the coverage on the opposite side, the sun came out, melted all the frost. So we had to shoot the scene over again. That particular moment that you just saw with Roger and Bree, he was supposed to come out from the desk and we were supposed to see him in his boxers with his bare legs and that reaction, but he didn't quite step out far enough. So we did everything in our power to get that visual in there, but it just didn't quite ever make it to the gag was, what should I wear? And, you know, there he is. He's been working in his boxers the whole time. The gag didn't quite work out the way I had hoped. That question comes up a lot, you know, is, you know, over the years, it's come up a lot is, you know, not everything goes exactly the way I envision. You know, I work on from day one, from the break all the way through to the locked cut, is I'm working on these episodes into the scripts. We know if obviously if I'm not writing it myself, you know, I'm working with the writer who is writing it, and we're doing notes, we're revising, we're trying to tweak it and get it just right. So we continue, these scripts are always a work in progress, and trying to get them, you know, perfect to time, because that's a big thing. You can have a 55 page script and it could end up being, you know, 75 minutes worth of material. And, you know, we've over the years, you know, tried to work that to where we're doing 50 page scripts and trying to get to time. There's always going to be more footage because that's what editing is. You edit it down to its essence. But yeah, I really like this line. So I'm going to let us all listen to it because it's one of those pure Outlander lines. Sorry, that was T again. I tend not to have too many favorites, but there's ones this one right here. Anyway, I thought that was both dead on and really heartwarming that he would kind of get the essence of who Claire is right off the bat. Again, I sorry, forgive. Started watching the show, lost my train of thought on what I was talking about. Work. I know I was talking about working on scripts, in the process, and the question I had it. So completely lost it. We'll move on. That's what you get when you get me alone. Just talking about things. I like and the challenges of working on Outlander. I think when Richard knew he was going to do this section, he really loved it. He wanted to do the Gallic. In a lot of ways, when we get into these sections with Gaelic or the Scottish culture, many of our Scots who work on the crew and the cast really dig into it, really love doing it because it shows their culture in a way that you just don't normally get on a show or in movies. And pretty proud that when we do a culture, that we dig into it. We talk to the experts. We talk to people who know about it. And you could be Italian, but doesn't make you an Italian culture expert. You could be, Polish, but it doesn't make you a Polish culture expert. And I think the same applies to, Scots or Mohawks or Cherokee or whatever. So we try to go to experts who, work in the museums and work in the schools and who've studied the culture for years, and we talk to them about it, and their enthusiasm, for us is infectious because they know we're going to try to do it as right as possible. I think that's our reputation out there in the world, is that when Outlander does something, we try to do it as authentic as we possibly can. And that's our qualifier. That's my qualifier, is we are not a documentary. We are not going to replicate it in some identical fashion. And a lot of things that happened in certain the 1700s is we don't know for sure. We have accounts. We have paintings. And just like with you take anybody's Facebook or Instagram account, and a lot of times that's their polished version of themselves. It's not real life in a sense. And when you see a portrait of someone or a painting of the time, that's a polished version of that moment. It's a polished version of that person. It's not their day-to-day lives normally. So we have to take that into account when we're trying to recreate. So we read journals. Journals for me have been fantastic. Accounts that have been preserved, oral testimony that's been recorded by somebody, and you get more of the day-to-day real life of what people went through and what we're going through, and try to immerse yourself. Certainly I did back in the day, when we started this. You immerse yourself in that in the day-to-days, and then it certainly helps you when you're making decisions on what we can tell and what we can't tell, where to put our efforts and into what we want to show, as opposed to, and I say this quite often, is the book can show and do anything, whereas we have to pick our moments. In this particular season, and again, being completely open, when we started, we thought this was going to be our last season, and we everything into each and every episode. And knowing that, you know, I can't remember the date when we found out we were getting a season 8. It, you know, obviously exciting news. We started to, at least I started to shift out of, okay, we don't have to put every story point into season 7, certainly at the end, that we can now save stuff and put stuff in season 8. So that was both, you know, exciting news, but then terrifying as well, because when you put all your effort into doing this final season, you go, oh, you got to rethink everything at that moment. But we have a good plan going forward. So there's that. Super excited. Everybody's super excited that we get another season. I think not only the fans who, you know, rumor has it, you guys are pretty excited that we're doing season 8. So we are too. We want to go out with, you know, on a high, and we want to do things right. We just don't want to, you know, didn't want to wedge the ending of what I think is a pretty amazing series, you know, and just kind of wedge an ending in there. That's not fair to anybody, and it's not going to be what we do. So luckily we got season 8, and it's going to be it's going to be fantastic. But you know what, that's me. I'm not going to give you any spoilers. You guys know me better than that. But things will happen. A lot of things. Oh, good old Rob Cameron. We cut this scene a few times in the sense that hymn book gave us some the issues. And I will say, though, Rob Cameron's pretty bold. You know, he just invites himself to. He's bringing wine already. He's like, hey, I'm going to eat at your house and you're cooking. I don't know if that's ever happened to me before. But, you know, Rob Cameron, he's Rob Cameron. So we kind of went round and round about that and how pushy he was. But, you know, he had to get there. He had to get to the house. Sorry, throat getting dry. So, sad moment for Claire. Sad moment for everyone, actually. For Walter. I like this little story with her and Walter. I think a lot of times we can get lost in trying to do the bigger story, the bigger picture. And again, I'll always go back to these little small moments that make Outlander. I think also, you know, working out the timeline in this episode covers some ground. So she was literally just with Walter, who passed. And then you have a scene 5 seconds later where she's walking, you know, carrying water buckets. And, you know, again, this gives me some issues in post where I want a buffer, but I'm running out of time. I want a breather for the audience, for you guys to go, okay, I need another scene here to break it up, to give Claire a moment to herself, to take in what just happened with Walter. But unfortunately, in this particular episode, there was a lot going on, both in this time period and the other story in 1980s. So didn't have room. Ultimately, long story. That was a long story for I didn't have room. And that's probably, you know, the ongoing major challenge of Outlander is trying to fit all this story in a finite amount of time. And you try to get as much story in as possible. And you, again, the balance of plot and character is big for us, where there are shows out there that can just do all plot. You know, a procedural is basically all plot, you know, famously Law and Order, you know, is just nothing but plot. They don't, there's no, not a lot of character beats in Law and Order. Great show. You can pop in anytime. You can watch any episode and it works. But for us, we need to balance plot that pushes the story forward and character, which makes, you know, you want to care about the characters. This is one of those added moments where it didn't take a lot of convincing to have Sam shooting arrows, but we didn't originally have this. We didn't have Sam shooting the arrows. The arrows were just flying in and Jamie wasn't a part of it. When I saw the cut, it was like, no, we absolutely need to see him doing it. So, you know, we got a second unit together and, you know, having Sam shoot some arrows, he was like, oh, he was fully game. And we added that in, but it makes more sense now that you see it. So you get to physically see the action as opposed to, you know, imagine it. And that was the argument early on. Well, we can imagine because Jamie had said, let me have your bow and arrows, that we knew he was doing it. And just in the cut, you go, no, we need to physically see it. So that's when I talk about an ongoing process, that's what that means. So a lot of times when and certainly in the seasons past, when you see read scripts, when they post them and you watch the episode and they don't always match up, scenes move around, even though the scene will be there, it just might be in a different spot. Here's a great example of Dave. We shoot this in the day and then in post, we create more of a nighttime scene. And even though it's not dark, dark night, you feel like it's moving towards there. And this was all in trying to keep track of the continuity of the days and nights as we were going through this episode, because this one in particular was very difficult. It created some continuity issues and we were trying to work them out. And like I said, all this stuff is planned out, and then you get there and certain things happen and then you move something in the cut, and say I take a daytime scene and move it to a nighttime moment in the story. Now you go, well, I cuss worse than that, but you go, now what do we do? How do we make something that was supposed to be someplace else work in this moment now? And again, I don't remember every single script verbatim from the first the first writer's draft to the final production draft, but I do go, okay, what's the cut look like? And how is the cut evolving? How is the cut story? Because at the end of the day, that's the story. The script is the scripts, the blueprint of what we're going to film. But at the end of the day, it's the what we filmed is all we have. And sometimes, yes, we reshoot things for many different reasons. Weather, you know, continuity. There's certain things that just didn't work out. Or we need added scenes. So you watch an episode and like that moment where Jamie was shooting the arrows wasn't originally there. And we go, okay, that we need it. And that's happened over and over and over again throughout, you know, from day one, you know, from Outlander, We did multiple reshoots in season one where we had something. It wasn't that it wasn't good, it just didn't fit. So we have to refilm it to fit. The things that often give us more challenge than we imagine, and then maybe you imagine, are children and animals. Because they don't always do what you hope they do. They do other things, and you have to make that work. So making Rolo sit where he's supposed to sit and walk where he's supposed to walk and pay attention to who they're supposed to pay attention to within the scene sometimes doesn't work. So I don't know if you noticed, but we're waist high, we're staying waist high, and the reason we're staying waist high is because there's a dog down there, that dog. And the dog doesn't have to be in the shot when we're waist high. Now, when you go to the master, the wide, then obviously he needs to be there. So that's one of the tricks of the trade. Stay off the dog, stay off the dog, stay off the child, whatever it is, and you frame the shot to help you out. So these guys, John and Izzy, could do the whole scene without the dog even there. And they're looking down at a blank spot in the grass. And then only in the wide is the dog there. And again, helps with shooting, helps with timing. It helps, you know, with everything. We do that with kids as well. And then you bring the dog in the moment you need it. But as the Outlander world grows, this means more animals, more kids. I thought that one of the questions we got from season four on, I think, is what happened to the white sow. And I will tell you this, is that the pigs aren't, you know, they're not production friendly in that sense. Certainly not the way it was written in the book. So we had to kind of, the white sow's got its own little pen somewhere on Fraser's Ridge. I don't know where it is, but it's somewhere, and the white sow's living a happy life. So these little camps that we had to set up over, that's your main title shot, if you remember it from the main title. One of the big things about the camp, setting the camps up, because they travel so much this season, is how to make them look different. You know, so you set up a camp. We'll go and find a nice section of land, and we'll find one corner, and we'll go, this area will be a camp for these episodes. And then we'll move to another side of that same area, and we'll go, okay, this camp will be when, on Saratoga, or this camp will be near Ticonderoga, or this camp will be, you know, when they're camping in North Carolina. So you try to make it, when we look for a place, serviceable is so first off, it has to match the story. It has to be gorgeous. Has to be, you know, does this fit the story? And then it has to be serviceable. Can we get people in? I remember once we had probably just one of the most glorious spots that I've seen in Scotland, and it was just fantastic. All along this river, and there were these little caves and outcry. Oh, it's just really a fantastic spot. And the director we were working with really wanted it. And so the UK producer at the time and I walked from that spot to where we were going to be able to put the nearest bathroom, or, you know, like a outhouse type thing. And it was a 20-minute walk. And in the scheme of things, you think, okay, that's that's not that bad. But if you're, say, an actress in 14 layers and you have to walk 20 minutes because you couldn't get cars in there, you couldn't get a vehicle in there. So how do you, they have to walk out? That's 20 minutes. Know, go use the restroom. And that means taking off layers and then walking all the way back. So you lose 45 minutes for one time. So that's what makes it not serviceable. You have to kind of give up on. So when we go to those places, when we go to these places on top of a high ridge in the highlands, or next to a lock somewhere, it has to be for a miraculous reason, and it absolutely has to fit the story. But believe it or not, a lot of these places down, 100 yards away, or is a tech pad with restrooms and honey wagons and things like that that we can service. And that amount of effort that goes in to servicing these locations that we go to is miraculous, to put a big word on it. Is it always astonishes me when we go to these places and I see base camps and tech pads, and tech camp set up, and you just go, wow, our crew is so amazing. They are just absolutely fantastic to get this machine working, where Katrina and Sam, or whoever the actors are, can walk on set and do give their best performance and not think about all that went in to this particular moment. And I cannot praise them enough, and I know I do it in each and every podcast because I should, because without them, we are just a bunch of people standing around talking to each other at the end of the day. So everything, all my praise and it goes to our crew and our cast too, and our writers and all our producers and our staff, support staff, who absolutely bend over backwards. They're so dedicated to our show and loyal, and I've never been prouder to work with a group of people in my entire life. That goes all the way back to my first job as a paper boy. And I enjoyed everybody I worked with there, except all the ink, those back in the day. I just dated myself, where you actually, had paper and you delivered it to people's doors, from a bike. But we've tried to do more of these particular moments. I know I segued there, so back to reality. These moments where you have Jamie and Claire having conversations about the meaning of what the world is and where they're going, and their, not their relationship, because that's as steadfast as time itself. So we, but to have those moments where they get to share their feelings with each other. And I was go back to, what I was talking about a long time ago in this particular podcast, is the balance of character moments, which that was, and the balance of plot. And over the seasons, I have learned more than I think anybody, is that we need more and more of those character moments to drive our story forward. And we can get by with less plot because, one, our audience is kind of knows the way. They know where we're going anyway. Anyway, that is episode 706, Where the Waters Meet. I hope you guys enjoyed it. We have a couple more episodes coming up before we take a little mid-season break. Really exciting, a lot of stuff coming up. So I'm glad you could join me here. I hope you got a little information that you didn't have before. And if you knew it all, then great. And I'll end up talking to you on the next podcast. But wherever you are in the world, have a great day or have a great night. And thank you for joining me on the official Outlander podcast. Until next week. Bye bye.